Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Today we're going to take a look at history from here in South Africa, and it's from almost 300 years ago. In 2 years' time, this event will have taken place 300 years ago exactly. And this is a story from Dutch history. And I just want to comment a bit about history, because the more that I look at history, the more that I think about history, the more that I study all kinds of history, the more I find myself asking this question: how in hell's name is it possible that Americans, white Americans, and Europeans can end up becoming liberals and believing in globalism? And above all, believing in diversity and in races coming together and mixing together in European countries and in America, when all the history of white Americans as well as Europeans actually teaches you very clearly and shows you very clearly that these things are not going to work. The number of lessons that can be pulled out of history that will shatter diversity and liberalism into tiny little pieces is beyond imagination. The scale of the experiments that have been conducted by whites over hundreds of years, and also even over thousands of years, every single one of those things has a result that flies totally in the face of diversity and liberalism. And every one of those things shows you that this is a bunch of claptrap that cannot work. These are not just experiments that have taken place in one tiny little town somewhere. These things have taken place across huge countries, and in a number of cases, across entire continents. And it's all sitting there, staring you in the face, showing you the differences between humans, and showing you what happens when groups of humans meet each other. And another question that I ask myself is, how in hell's name is it possible that you can get people into parliament, into government, who are making big decisions for nations, and these people haven't got the faintest knowledge of history? They either don't know anything about history, or they don't know anything about human biology and science. It is very rare to find people with a good, solid knowledge of history who are actually making laws. And yet these people are doing completely idiotic things, which anyone with the most basic knowledge of history would turn around and tell you, no man, that's crazy shit. That cannot work because it failed here and here and here. The examples that can be found in history are just innumerable. And I also think about children and young people who ask about why should they learn history. Well, the answer is actually very straightforward. History is the most complete record of knowledge of human behavior and human group behavior over long periods of time. It is the perfect lens through which to study humans and human behavior in groups and in large groups over long periods of time. The amount of information that you can glean from this is tremendous. You do not have to go and make the same old mistakes again and again. In the past, whites had a much better grasp of history than they do these days, I must tell you. Capitalism, Jews, and liberals has made us completely stupid. Here and there you'll find a professor of history who's in Congress or the Parliament, and one such example in America is Newt Gingrich. He was a professor of history and geography. And geography is also important, especially when it comes to warfare and other important things that relate to nations. I don't think that you should be allowed into Parliament or Congress or any high-ranking government institution if you don't have a solid grasp of history. When I look at what Jews and liberals are doing, they are basically dumbing people down. They are making stupidity the norm. It's a case of dumb and dumber. And if they are left alone, then the white race and Western civilization is going to enter a very dark period. It's going to be like the Middle Ages, the time before the Renaissance, the time between the Roman Empire and the Renaissance. In fact, it's going to be much worse than that, where all important knowledge that has been discovered by whites is going to be lost, because Jews need to hide the facts of history and science, the very facts that people like Hitler were bringing to people's attention. These lessons are lessons that everybody should be learning in school. There is no question in my mind that white children need to get a racial education and a political education in school. So today we're going to take a look at some events that took place here in South Africa almost 300 years ago. We're going to take a look at some of the activities of the Dutch here in South Africa. The existence of the Boers is a direct result, simply a byproduct, actually, of a greater thing that the Dutch were up to at that time. And out of this event that we're going to take a closer look at, you're going to see a whole bunch of different stuff. And we're going to learn a whole bunch of lessons from 300 years ago, from 100 years before Napoleon was around, from a time before Frederick the Great was around. And as we look closely at that, you are going to see a bunch of stuff that will give you a much deeper insight into what blacks were like and what Africa was like. And you'll begin to understand more about the kind of garbage that Jews and liberals have been telling you about the past. This story is a story that I've wanted to tell for quite a long time, and it comes from an Englishman who was quite a famous author in South Africa. He wrote an interesting little book that had to do with battles that were fought in South Africa that were weird battles that didn't have anything to do with any particular war. There are a lot of very strange and weird things that have happened in South Africa in the past. And so many different nations and people and countries have interacted with this land that we now know as South Africa, that you'd be quite surprised by some of the bizarre things that have happened here in South Africa. And there are many lessons from these different events. So let's take a look at the Dutch and a Dutch adventure that took place here in South Africa almost 300 years ago. And this adventure lasted about almost 3 weeks, between 2 to 3 weeks. And this took place more than 100 years before the Boers came into existence, before the Boers started leaving the Cape, and before the Boers wanted to try to find their own countries. So the regions that were later occupied by the Boers and where the Boers fought battles with other blacks, those regions are free of whites. So this is South Africa, or rather the northern part of South Africa, before the whites came and settled here. If you look at the screen in front of you, you'll see on the left a photo of an 18th century cargo ship of the Dutch East India Company. You'll see a very beautiful vessel that is there in the Netherlands. Now, the existence of whites in southern Africa is mostly an accident, especially in the case of the Boers. The Boers, who are the longest running Europeans who've lived in South Africa continuously, are actually a direct offshoot, an incidental event that relates to another project that the Dutch were busy with hundreds of years ago. The Dutch and the Portuguese and the Spanish were among the first who went out, and they were using the greatest technology of their time. And this ship that you see here, this ship from 300 years ago, this is actually just one of many wondrous creations that came out of Europe. This kind of stuff was the free energy transport vehicle that could sail around the world. The story of navigation and of these sailing ships is itself actually a fantastic story. This is a serious story of high technology, high technical skill, including mathematics, engineering, astronomy. There's a lot of stuff that went into the creation of these ships, and for these ships to have the capability to sail thousands and tens of thousands of miles away from Europe. These things were the jet aircraft of their day. They were the supersonic aircraft of their time. And if you really study, as I have done, the ships that went to the North Pole and to the South Pole, and the things that the white men did in those terrible regions, you begin to realize that these sailing ships were like the NASA space missions of their time. I'm not joking with you. The things that men got up to with these sailing ships up in the Arctic and down in the Antarctic, the dangers they faced, the things they went through, the hell they lived through, and there were many who died because these things that they were doing were so dangerous. If you really start to grasp sailing ships, then you'll realize this was the greatest achievement before the European people learned how to fly. And with these ships, they could travel to the other side of the earth. They could go and fight people on the other side of the world 300 and more years ago. This was the projection of European power all across the earth. And once whites broke away from Europe, led by the Portuguese, who were the first to get going with this kind of idea, wondrous things came from this, and this led to all the European empires. This led to the European people seizing control of probably 80 or 90% of the entire earth, and out of this came incredible adventures. Now, in the image to the right of that, you see a soldier with a musket with a bayonet. That is the uniform of one of the Dutch East India Company soldiers in the late 1700s. That is from about 1783. So those are the kinds of troops that were carried around on these ships. The formation of these companies, the Dutch East India Company, the British South Africa Company, and many other companies, this was itself actually a very ingenious thing. And it allowed European countries to build these expensive ships and load them up with supplies and with equipment and send them on dangerous missions. And these ships could end up sinking. The sailors and soldiers could end up getting killed, and it was a very high-risk business. This stuff was as high-risk as the early days of air travel, the early days of space travel. It was high-risk stuff. And it astounds me that men could go away from Europe and sometimes be away for years at a time. And their wives and their families don't know if they're alive, they don't know what's going on. But the whole way in which all this stuff worked is itself actually quite fascinating. You'd be amazed at how interesting some of the old technology of whites actually is when you really get down to it. But I will tell you that the age of sail is actually an incredible time. So here were the Europeans dashing off to other continents, meeting other people, and conquering them and figuring out all kinds of things. Our race was out and about in a big way, and it was awesome. Imagine now, 300 years later, all of us cringing in Western countries. Oh, we're cringing, cringing away. These blacks from Africa are going to take us over. No, man. 300 years ago, the white man was everywhere, and he was busy taking everyone else over. And when you start to understand more about the world and about races and about history and warfare, the more you will realize that, you know what? What was done in the past can be done again. Don't be fooled by any of the hocus pocus that you hear from Jews and liberals. These people are idiots, liars, and fools, and they are misleading you regarding everything. And these soldiers, like this Dutch soldier that you see here, by the time we get to the end of this video, you're going to have some serious respect for these guys, because you're going to see the kind of things that these white men could face back then. For the purposes of this video, I wanted to show people the exact location where these events took place 300 years ago, because that in and of itself is also very instructive. So if you look at this map in front of you, this is a map of the northern part of South Africa. So here you have Pretoria, and there you can see Johannesburg, where I am. And if you look over here, this country over here, this is Mozambique. This used to be Portuguese Mozambique. This country here is Rhodesia, now known as Zimbabwe. So the area that we're interested in is from this place where there's this capital city called Maputo. And in the green over here is the Kruger National Park. The Kruger National Park was created by Paul Kruger, who was the president of the Transvaal, the Boer Republic, and he created this a long time ago. So the Kruger National Park is known for its wildlife, and it runs along the border with Mozambique. So these Dutch that we're going to take a look at, these Dutch have set up a base in what was known as Delgoa Bay, and nowadays the capital of Mozambique, known as Maputo, is there. It used to be known by the Portuguese name of Lourenço Marques. There are various pieces of evidence of other European activity in the Kruger National Park. On this image in front of you, on this tree, this is a cross that was carved into a tree in the Kruger National Park. It's called the Das Neves Cross. And this is from much later. This is from about the 1860s. And it's a cross that a Portuguese elephant hunter may have carved into one of the trees. That is the most likely explanation for it. But that's from 1860. We're going to go back to 1725 and the Dutch. This small band of Dutch that we're going to be taking a look at, they've come from the Maputo area, Delgoa Bay. And what you see on the screen in front of you is a plan for a fort called Late Saamhait. Late Saamhait. And this fort was built by the Dutch East India Company in 1720. The most important fort that we've got in South Africa from our past European history is actually in Cape Town. That fort is used as the symbol for the South African military. In the time of apartheid, that fort was on all kinds of insignia, including military uniforms. But this image that you see, this drawing that you see, is the fort in Maputo, late Saamhait. In the Kruger National Park is this tiny little monument that you see on the screen in front of you. And this is the best picture that I can get of it. And this little monument is a monument commemorating the exact location where this small group of Dutch soldiers were ambushed by blacks. And you can see there's a plaque on it there, which we will read shortly. But this will give you an idea of the location and what it looks like nowadays. And I'll show you the details on a map shortly. I just want to show you the maps again, along with a Google Earth map, so that you can see the exact path that they took. So here on this map, this is the original map I showed you. There you can see the Kruger National Park. Now on this Google Earth map, we are zooming in to this area. So these red lines with the arrows show the direction in which these Dutch soldiers were walking. So they went from Maputo, from that fort, and they went into South Africa. And their goal was to get somewhere around about here, which is at Phalaborwa. And it is at this little monument that I showed you, that monument is over here. And it is at this little monument that the blacks attacked them. But it wasn't the only battle that was fought. There was a lot that went on. But I just want to show you approximately where they were going so that you have it in the back of your mind when I go through the story. Now let's take a look at that plaque on the little monument and then you'll see what it says. It says, on the 12th of July, 1725, Frans de Kuyper and his 30 men were ambushed in this vicinity by Chief Dawano's warriors. The expedition was forced to retreat across the Lebombo Range to the Dutch East India Company's Fort Late Saamhait at Lorenzo Marks. And then below it, it's got the same thing in Afrikaans. So these Dutch troops came from that fort and they'd walked through what is now Mozambique. And they were now into the area that's known as South Africa. And you'll discover all their adventures that they had in this 2 to 2.5 week event. And you'll see how nasty it got. And you're going to learn a whole bunch of stuff about blacks and whites, and also about a lot of things that they tell you about the blacks of those times. You're about to discover some interesting stuff. In this book that I'm reading from, this particular author also likes to dawdle around at the beginning of each chapter, where he starts talking about other things. And he dawdles around for a while. Some of the stuff isn't that interesting, but I'm going to read some of it, which also gives you a little bit of an insight into some of the things that have happened in the past. So the author is writing about the Kruger National Park, and he says, there have been many savage struggles to the death between animals, some witnessed and many more unseen in the bush or in the dark. Occasionally, as in the case of Ranger Volhutter or Volhutter, who fought and killed a lion with a small knife, or anonymously with the human migration, read blacks, from Mozambique, animals have confronted man. So I think some of the animals may have been munching on the blacks, which I don't have a problem with. The animals are mostly on the side of whites, I must tell you. He continues, occasionally too, there is evidence of man taking on his fellow species in bitter contest. For instance, on the Crocodile River Road, and he gives a position there, there is an Anglo-Boer War monument recording the fact that on 16 September 1900, at that point south of the Crocodile River, the Boer forces under General Ben Viljoen spiked and destroyed most of their artillery pieces and ammunition to save them falling into the hands of the approaching British army under General Pole Carew. He then tells the story about the Das Neves cross that was carved into a tree, and now he starts talking about that little monument with the plaque on it. And he says, the plaque fixed to a stone cairn is tantalizingly cryptic. On the 12th July 1725, it reads, Frans de Kuyper and his 30 men were ambushed in this vicinity by Chief Dawano's warriors. The expedition was forced to retreat across the Lebombo Range to the Dutch East India Company's fort at Leidzaamheid at Lorenzo Marques. Intriguing. When first I read it, I wanted to learn more. Little known, certainly to me, was the fact that the Dutch once occupied Delagoa Bay. When early into the 18th century, the Portuguese at the port of Mozambique, in the north of present-day Mozambique, began to neglect Delagoa Bay, which was at that time only visited by dangerous pirates, the Dutch took the opportunity to step into the vacuum. So basically, the Dutch now grab a port on the east coast of southern Africa in a territory that would later be dominated totally by the Portuguese. So now the story gets interesting. Start listening carefully, because you're going to see some interesting things going on here. It continues, rumors of gold in the interior were the main motivation. On 14 February 1720, two small ships, the Carp and Gouda, accompanied by the Zeelandia, left Table Bay, that's down in Cape Town, with a small band of soldiers, sailors, and craftsmen under a clerk called Willem van Taak. They arrived at Delagoa on 29 March. The local Batonga chief, Mafumbo, subordinate to Mateke, welcomed them cordially. The Dutch set about constructing a pentagonal earthwork fort, which was named Fort Lagoa. Within weeks, two-thirds of the over 100 colonists were dead of fever. So just ponder that. Let's just stop there. Within a couple of weeks, two-thirds of the Dutch had died of disease. The Dutch had died of disease. You've heard the Jews and the liberal scum all whining about how the white man killed everybody else and everybody else died of the white man's diseases. But hey, white people also died. And lots of them died. Two-thirds of 100 people were dead. So it continues. In August, the Zeelandia brought 80 soldiers as reinforcements. A trickle of copper, iron, gold, and ivory coming in as trade goods prompted enough interest at the station to equip an expedition of 19 men under Jan Steffler to venture into the interior in August 1723. They reached pleasant countryside in the Lebombo Mountains before being attacked by local tribesmen who forced them to turn back. So let's just pause there. These blacks, there are blacks in these areas, and the blacks meet the Dutch and they talk. And as these Dutch are setting up their fort and they're busy building their stuff, they are clearly starting to trade with the blacks. And it's the blacks who are bringing stuff. And so they are looking at the stuff and probably buying and exchanging those things for whatever it is that the blacks want. And so it says a trickle of copper, iron, gold, and ivory is coming in. And they're seeing, there's something coming from the interior of this country. So they send off a little expedition with a guy called Jan Steffler, and they manage to go a distance into the interior, and then the blacks attack them and chase them back. So you can see that the blacks occupy these areas, and the blacks have got some kind of military force. This is their territory. But now the Dutch are starting to get interested. They want to know what's going on in there, further inside this piece of territory, where this stuff is coming from. So to recap, they had come there in 1720, they had built their fort, people had died, they got reinforcements, and 3 years later, the Dutch make their first little venture into this territory, and then they chase back. Then in 1724, in May of 1724, let's see what happens. It says, in May 1724, Jan van der Kapel, a junior officer who proved more resilient than most against fever, was appointed secunde, deputy governor at Fort Lagoa in Delagoa Bay. Persistent hints of a rich gold field associated with the great empire of Mono Matapa led him to send another party to search for it. So let's just pause there. So now there is talk that there's a lot of gold, and the gold is inside a great black empire. And it is run by a guy called Amona Matapa. Now, in Rhodesia, they actually built a Monomotapa hotel in Salisbury when I was young. And there was a lot of talk that hundreds of years earlier that there had been a great kingdom, a great black African kingdom in what is Rhodesia. And it was led by this guy called the Monomotapa. But I'll be honest with you, I've never really come across evidence in recent times that such a thing really existed. The Zimbabwe ruins that were a big tourist attraction in Rhodesia, the Zimbabwe ruins was thought to be part of that kingdom of the Monomotapa. So it is interesting that here, from the South African point of view, that these Dutch in that time heard of this great empire. So the blacks have got a huge, powerful empire, and it's rich. But now the Dutch are curious. They want to go and see this place. They want to start checking it out. And the Dutch are going to try again and again. But again, it shows you that the Dutch are talking to the blacks. There is information and goods moving backwards and forwards. But now the Dutch want to go and investigate for themselves. They want to see what exactly is this stuff. So returning to 1724, this new deputy governor then authorizes another team to go. Sergeant Johannes Mona led 31 men, including a clerk who was assigned to keep a journal. His name was Frans de Kuyper. And this guy writes, some of the places he subsequently recorded are identifiable, others are lost in the mists of history. So clearly, he kept a very interesting diary, and some things could be verified later, but other things couldn't be found. They set out on Wednesday, 27 June 1725. Aside from Mona and de Kuyper, there was a corporal, a drummer, an undermaster, an overseer of the pack animals, 20 soldiers, and 5 sailors. And if you look on the screen in front of you, I've got an image of more or less what the uniforms of the Dutch East India Company were like in the 1700s. That image is from the 1780s, but it'll give you an idea of how the Dutch were dressed. There were also 8 interpreters and servants. For the transport of the provisions, there were 10 pack animals for dinner on the hoof. There were 8 head of cattle. So just to tell you about the art of refrigeration in previous times, before electricity and all these modern inventions. If you wanted to keep your meat fresh, you kept it alive. So those cattle that are going there, those 8 head of cattle, they are basically the walking deep freeze. And they'll be kept alive and they'll be killed as and when they need more meat. So they've got 10 pack animals and 8 cattle that they will be slaughtering for meat as they carry on their trip. They're planning for quite a long trip. At first, they passed through the territory of Chief Matole, and the locals took to their heels at the sight of them. So this must be the first time that some of these blacks have seen whites, and they run away from the whites. And as you can see, the blacks function like the Red Indians. They've got their chiefs, they've got their pieces of territory that they live in, etc. Let's continue. It was not an auspicious beginning. When they came across a river, probably the Matola, they named it the Olifants, Olifants being Dutch for elephants, because they saw plenty full signs of the eponymous animal. So he's just being fancy there. He's telling you that there were lots of signs of elephants there. And they spent a day exploring it. An encounter with the locals in the area of Muambo, in the territory of Chief Samani, this is now another chief, led to the chief promising to supply guides to take the Dutch to Nasangano, who seems to have been their immediate goal. So as they are walking, they're actually walking from one piece of territory ruled by this black to another piece of territory ruled by another black. But they've got interpreters, they are talking to the blacks, they are negotiating, and they're actually getting permission to travel through these territories. But they are armed, they aren't stupid. It continues. When they reached the Komati River on 1 July, one of their party went to visit Nasangano's brother-in-law, whose kraal was nearby. A kraal is basically a village, whose kraal was nearby, and returned with the ominous report that the chiefs had instructed their people to murder the travelers and punish their guides. So you see, they are chit-chatting with the blacks, they're getting information, and now they hear from their contact that the chiefs have told the blacks to murder the Dutch and to punish the blacks who are assisting the Dutch. So now the blacks are hiding stuff, and the blacks don't want these Dutch to walk further into their territory. And it seems that multiple black chiefs have been talking and have received intelligence of these white men who are walking through their territory. So Nasangano's brother-in-law has now been a very useful provider of intelligence. And it says, the brother-in-law was brought in to the camp and he confirmed the report. He also said that there was some gold and a lot of silver in an area that he called Kupani Sirimandel. Much more gold at another place called Belule, and gold, copper, and ivory at a place called Simingele. So here's this guy telling them that further inside this territory, there's more and more riches here. Kupane was, he added, 6 days away. So in other words, you walk for 6 days. 2 of which were without water, so it's dry. He did not want to lead the expedition there. So this guy is saying there's a lot of wealth and it's not far away. You can get there within a week. The Dutch rested the next day, invited Samani to the camp and offered him a drink and snuff. Let me just pause there. Snuff and tobacco products were things that these blacks liked once the whites introduced them to it. So they finally get to this chief that they're looking for, Samani, and they invite him to the camp. Anyway, it says that they offered him a drink and snuff. The first he disliked. He didn't like the drink. But the snuff, the second he enjoyed enormously. So he loves snuff. Half a thousand of his followers looked on with curiosity, many seeing white people for the first time. So the drummer was asked to play, and the chief called up more drums from the village, and the dancing went on until sunset. So here are 500 of the chief's followers, and now they are playing the drums, and they're seeing these white people for the very first time, and there's a party going on. The expedition traveled past Makangani and Makanji, and crossed the Sonduen River, perhaps the Masondwini or Klip River. On Thursday, 5 July, they sent ahead scouts who were told that Kupani, this is the place where there's wealth, where there is some gold and a lot of silver, who were told that Kupani was 3 hours away, but over very difficult mountainous terrain and a river crossing, which was too deep to manage. So these Dutch have just carried on. They've carried on through the territory of the blacks, and the blacks know what they are doing, etc. And they are scouting things out, talking to locals, etc. So it continues. In fact, the doubting Dutch found another crossing, only 4 feet deep and a pistol shot wide, further upstream. So it is as if the Dutch are starting to doubt what the blacks are telling them, and they're being told how difficult it is, and then the Dutch find an easy way to get across this river. The author here says, one wonders if this was not the Crocodile River. Now listen to this. They, the Dutch, had come to realize that the local population were very unhappy with us having come there to explore the land. So let me pause there. The blacks are now starting to fear this small band of white people. They don't like this little band of white people wandering in their territory and exploring. One has to wonder why, and I've raised the issue before about blacks having experience with whites in other places, knowing about things, and the blacks see these whites, and it might just be a small party, but they might be afraid of these white people and what these white people can do if more of them come in the future. It continues, over the next few days, Chief Kupani proved elusive. They were told he had left for the mountains, and nobody knows exactly which mountains, to buy cattle, having instructed those left behind not to provide any assistance to the newcomers, the Dutch. They were told he would return in 3 days. When they proceeded, they heard that he was in the nearby settlement of his father, Alari Motsari. Then they heard that he had left that morning, but would join them at the Muganji River. He never did. Let me just pause there. It should become obvious that there's a hell of a lot of communication that's going on as these Dutch are walking through this black territory, that they have got blacks who are talking to other blacks, messages are being passed around, they're being told the chief is here, now the chief is there, stick around, the chief will see you in 3 days' time, he doesn't pitch up. So there's a hell of a lot of communication and talking that's going on here. So it's not like these Dutch are sneaking around behind the blacks' backs and doing things that the blacks don't want. They are talking openly to the blacks. They're asking questions, they are getting answers, and they're getting curious. And they want to get to the bottom of this thing. They want to get to these places where this wealth is. And so they've got this idea that there's this huge empire and that there's all kinds of vast wealth. And the Dutch want to go and see this. They want to go see this amazing stuff. But as they're traveling, these blacks are becoming ever more unfriendly, and the blacks are getting weirder and weirder. But despite the Dutch being told a couple of days ago that the chiefs are planning to have them killed, the Dutch aren't a bunch of pussies. The Dutch are going and they want to go and see. So the chief never pitches up. And it continues. After they crossed the Morganji on the 10th, the air of menace increased. The journey was now accompanied by continuous shouting, blowing of horns, and rattling of assegais against shields. An assegai is a spear. So now, as these Dutch have crossed this river, now the blacks are shouting and making noise and blowing horns and rattling their assegais against their shields. So the blacks are now indicating to the whites that their presence is not wanted. So let's continue. The party prepared itself for the worst. When they inquired about the surrounding restlessness, they were told they must give up their guide and find their own way. So now they're not allowed to use a black to guide them. It continues. They did, however, acquire a replacement, and that evening reached a stream close to the settlement of Dawano. Next day, they were forced to stay put, owing to the exhaustion of the pack animals. They asked the headman, a headman is just another rank, it's almost like a chief. They asked the headman about the road to Sirimundel, approaching the matter as diplomatically as possible. But as often as they asked, so often did they receive a different answer. 5 days' journey with no water for 2 days. 7 days with some of them without water. A few days with water in abundance. Let me pause there. Here are the Dutch asking how to get to that place, because the Dutch clearly still haven't decided to give up yet. They are feeling the danger and feeling the unpleasantness, but they still want to get to one of these places. And now the blacks are giving them different answers. So the blacks are just making up shit, and they're giving them all kinds of answers that make no sense. So this black is lying to them here, another black is telling a lie elsewhere. The Dutch wanted to buy cattle. Two animals were brought, but when the sellers saw the barter beads, they spat and left with the animals, saying that they did not want these and preferred small blue ones, big yellow ones, and large white ones. Let's just stop there for a second. So here are the Dutch, and all throughout, as you can see, the Dutch are not killing anybody, the Dutch are not being violent, the Dutch are dealing diplomatically and openly with the blacks at all times. And now the Dutch want to buy some cattle. They want to buy 2 cattle. So in come some blacks who've got cattle to sell. But what I like is that the Dutch are bartering, it seems, with beads. And these blacks can't produce beads. And these little beads from Europe can get you a freaking cow. And this should show you how retarded their civilization is. That for them, those beads of different colors and sizes have meaning, and it's special to them. And I know that blacks like colorful stuff. So here are these beads from Europe. And yeah, it's not the same as gold, but hey, in this retarded continent, you can get a whole bunch of stuff from these blacks using these beads. But now these blacks are starting to get uppity and they don't like this color bead, but they want that color bead and they don't want this size, they want that size. Meanwhile, it doesn't matter which beads you take, they all have no value. It continues, indeed, the Kuiper had found the same thing ever since they had entered the land of Nasangano. They had been unable to buy a single animal for the beads they had. Even at Kupani's, five big bunches had been demanded for a single animal. So let me just pause there. It now becomes evident that the blacks have been instructed not to sell cattle to the whites. That ever since they entered this particular territory of Nasangano, that whenever they want to buy cattle, they go and they say to the blacks, we want to buy cattle. The blacks bring the cattle, and then the blacks come up with all kinds of reasons not to accept the barter beads. And it seems that the blacks are asking really extraordinary prices. It says, even at Kupani's, five big bunches had been demanded for a single animal. It looks to me like what the blacks are doing is the blacks have determined that they're not going to sell any cattle to these whites. They basically want the whites to run out of food. That's the bottom line here. But they're not telling the whites that they're not going to sell cattle to them. They come and they pretend to bring their cattle and then they negotiate and negotiate, and the whole goal is to eventually sell nothing to the whites. And they are making all kinds of weird and unreasonable demands, but their goal is not to sell to the whites. That night there was thunder and lightning and rain. Next morning, Thursday the 12th, they still could not proceed because of the condition of the animals. So De Kuyper questioned an elderly man who claimed to have travelled extensively beyond the land of Thawel. De Kuyper softened him up with a piece of meat and a drink. He was told that it was one day's journey to the Sabi River, another day to the kraal of Masawani, another to Matomes, two more to Sira Mandel. 5 days in all. Let me just pause there. It seems to me it doesn't matter how far the Dutch travel, it's always another 5 or 6 days. That is the thing about these black directions. So it continues. Sira Mandel was the place of copper. You had then to cross 10 rivers and pass many settlements before you reached the place of the great chief Intawel, or Intawele, where some gold was produced. But he highlighted Tsuke as the most important spot of all, where Portuguese ships would arrive to do business. He had himself seen the chief of Tsuke in his golden armor, and all of his subjects armed in copper. At Bombane, the inhabitants even wore gold necklaces. After an hour, the old man grew bored and left with a small gift. So let's just pause over there. So the old black guy now starts telling him wild stories. He starts saying that there is wealth here, like you cannot believe, that the chief wears golden armor and all of his subjects are armed in copper, and that some of the people even walk around with gold necklaces. So he's telling big stories of big stuff. And notice another thing is that the locations of these things seem to change. That, you know, this black says this thing is over here, that thing is over there, then another black says something else, then you've got to cross 2 rivers, and then it's cross 10 rivers, and some places there's water, some places there's no water. Notice how all the kinds of facts that these Dutch are getting, it's a whole mishmash of nonsense. And so you've got to ask yourself, are these blacks just making it up or lying deliberately to just fool the whites? Or are these blacks just telling stories that they think the whites want to hear in order to get something out of the whites? When I was at school in Rhodesia, one of our teachers told us that the blacks would give the whites the answers that the blacks think the whites want to hear. But in this case with the Dutch, you've also got instructions from the chiefs where the chiefs are saying, we're going to kill you and people mustn't assist them and their guides must go away, etc. So it should become obvious to you that in this world where these Dutch are, there is no such thing as a fixed fact. People don't have conceptions of truth as a thing that is important, that doesn't change, that is based on facts. In other words, what I say with my mouth must match up with actual reality. That is how all of us whites are conditioned. We are all conditioned like this. We understand that there's a thing called the truth, and we understand that the truth and reality must match up, and that when you say things, that it must match the truth. But for these people, they say anything they need to say, and they can change their stories, and some of them can go on their own missions and talk their own shit. These people do not see facts and talking as being as important as in our civilization. Our European civilization contains concepts that others don't use. But I want to return to some of our stuff that we do, because among our things, things like the truth and things like trust are things that have got tremendous value and tremendous benefits. For us as a civilization, we solve so many problems simply through discipline and good behavior. We are able to solve many problems and prevent many issues from occurring, and also we've got built-in efficiencies into our civilization that others don't have. Truth is one of them, because truth has got tremendous amounts of benefits, and the other one is high trust. You'll notice that it's not just the blacks who are low trust and who don't have a concept of fixed facts. There's a lot of this behavior that you also see among Jews. They also don't deal in reality and facts. European people deal in reality and hard facts. That's what we do. Anyhow, let's continue. So the old man grew bored and he got a small gift after he'd told his tall tales. So it continues. Now the Dutch realized that further progress was futile. Their animals were weak. Their beads were useless for barter. The locals were increasingly hostile. Even more serious was the fact that one of the pack animals had fallen into one of the rivers, and two-thirds of their gunpowder was spoiled. So here they are among hostile blacks, and much of their gunpowder is now useless. And they are far away from their base, and there are only 30 guys. Let's continue. As de Kuyper sat bringing his journal up to date at about 4 o'clock that afternoon, with his gun resting in front of him, he suddenly heard an alarmed cry. "Look out! Look out! Shoot!" He jumped to his feet, grabbed his gun, and passed the flintlock to the sentry, who began firing, straight away killing a warrior who was storming at them with a shield and assegai. At the same time, they could see attackers round them as numerous as the grasses of the veld. They were making such an awful noise with their whistling and blowing of horns and screams that the defenders could not understand what they shouted to each other, no matter how close they were. So the noise that these blacks who are surrounding them are making, the noise is so intense that even if the Dutch stand next to each other and shout at each other, they can't hear each other. There's so much freaking noise. They're under attack, and it says, But they closed ranks, they being the Dutch, and fired bravely at the, quote, dogs, who wanted to tear them apart like angry lions. With their first volley, they killed six of Dawano's men, and badly wounded at least 10 others. The attackers continued to hurl their assegais with great courage. So these blacks are throwing spears at them now, and they seem to be surrounded by a lot of blacks, because it says they were as numerous as the grasses of the veld. So it's like this small group of Dutch have suddenly been attacked by a large number of blacks. And so here are the blacks throwing spears at them. Two of the Dutch were seriously wounded. They had been ambushed in a thicket close to the encampment by members of Dawano's vanguard who had stalked them and wanted to steal their guns. The attack had evidently been planned with care. While the main body diverted the Dutch, others made for the cattle. Though when these stampeded towards the camp, they were killed with assegais. Seeing this, the Dutch retreated to open ground. The attackers surrounded them, but seeing the devastation caused by their gunfire, kept their distance, while maintaining all the while their terrifying cacophony being noise. Because of the serious shortage of gunpowder, Mona ordered his men to desist from shooting unless a point-blank target presented itself. The Dutch began an orderly retreat to the mountains. They were followed until about 7 that evening, when it was completely dark, assailed all the way by spears and stones. So the blacks followed them for hours on end, throwing spears and stones at them. And if it hadn't been for their guns and their shooting that scared the blacks, when the blacks saw what those muskets could do, the blacks would have killed them all. The blacks were coming in for the kill, definitely. And notice too that the blacks know that these guns are special, and the blacks have been trying to see if they can get a hold of those guns, those magic weapons that these white men have. So let's continue. When they were sure the bloodhounds, the blacks, had abandoned the chase, the shaken party decided to move into the mountains, marching in the cold night over terribly big boulders and through rivulets until 2 in the morning, when they broke through into flat country and could hear the barking of dogs from kraals. A kraal is basically a couple of huts. And could hear the barking of dogs from kraals in several directions. In order not to attract attention, they lay still. This they did for over an hour, until they were so dismally cold that their teeth began to rattle, and they all began to shake. So they got up and marched with their God's guidance, and were led by the stars through rocks and bushes and fields. So these Dutch are walking right through the night, and they are avoiding these kraals. And clearly the blacks have got dogs of some kind. They did not encounter anyone until 8 that morning, when they came across a large settlement with its inhabitants drawn up in front in a hostile manner. The Dutch prepared to shoot, asking for directions to the Komati River, which was to the right, south. They marched steadfastly on till midday, when they encountered 5 or 6 big kraals, where they were welcomed once more with assegais and stones. So everywhere they're going now, as they're trying to get back to their base, everywhere they are going, the blacks are meeting up with them and showing that they want to fight them. They are now totally unwelcome. De Kuyper asked them through an interpreter the reason for their aggression. Because the Dutch were passing through their land, they replied, and because they wanted everything that belonged to the Dutch, including their flintlocks, which they called Hongo Songilo, beautiful sticks. Rest assured, the blacks know that these aren't just beautiful sticks, that these are killing sticks. and they want those killing sticks of the whites. So it continues, the sergeant threw two bunches of beads towards them, and the soldiers threw some other trinkets, thinking that this might make them desist from their threats. Instead, they, the blacks, just shouted like mad dogs, Hote, hote, molongi, and that translates as, let us devour the white people. So there you have it, let us devour the white people. Doesn't that sound a lot like Julius Malema? Julius Malema in the stadiums where the blacks are shouting, kill the Boer, kill the farmer. In 300 years, what has changed? Nothing has changed. And when the blacks are large in number and they see this small group of whites, they now gang up on them. Now this tiny group of white men don't have any friends. But never at any time did they do anything harmful to these blacks. But now these blacks want to kill them. And their crime is for exploring inside the territory of the blacks. Okay, now I got some good news for you. So after they'd shouted, Hote, hote, molongi, let us devour the white people, when the Dutch heard this, they took aim and shot seven of their assailants, killing six and wounding one in the leg. Now there you've got it right. See, the Dutch were doing the right thing. They weren't liberal, they defended themselves. So they didn't take to being, to having blacks shouting at them, let us devour the white people. Instead, the white people popped some of them. It continues, at this, the warrior band took fright. There were about 500 of them, and most fled. So, you see, when you shoot back and you fight them, even though it's 500 of them against 30 Dutch, when the Dutch shoot some of them, then these blacks run. Now they were afraid of the sticks they had coveted, only a few allowed in the bush at a safe distance, and the Dutch reached the Komati River within half an hour. So only a handful of blacks dared to follow the Dutch after the Dutch had popped some of them. And it continues. The river was about half a cannon shot wide at that point, and as the party waded across, a number of their pursuers shouted over to the other bank, warning the inhabitants of the lethal nature of these intruders. The Dutch consequently marched on unhindered, and after 20 Dutch miles, they arrived at dusk at a great valley where a man from Mottekij greeted them and extended them much kindness. It was Friday the 13th. Next day, when they were again threatened, they told their interpreters to warn their shadowers that, at the slightest sign of attack, they would kill them all and burn down their houses. They had no further trouble. At daybreak on the 16th, they arrived at the settlement of Matoli, and a little after at Mafumbo, happy that they were nearing home. Here, the inhabitants greeted them with great joy, the women tearing branches from the trees and waving them above their heads. Others used the branches to sweep clean the path before them. Van der Kappel had sent his sergeant major to accompany them the rest of the way, and he had brought bread and some arak, A-R-A-K, that coarse but potent liquor from the east, which lifted their spirits enormously. They marched straight to the fortress in Delagoa Bay, where they were received by the commander. They had to report that they had done their duty, but that their expedition had failed. Well, one cannot fault them for trying to do what they had been ordered to do. They had truly tried their best, and they had really risked their lives. And it continues, other expeditions by land and river also returned empty-handed. So clearly the Dutch did not give up. Even after this, the Dutch did not quit. The fort turned out to be too small for the purposes asked of it, and a larger one called Fort Leidzaamheid was built. But the tiny mosquito was proving the most deadly enemy of all, causing a terrible death rate, And some investigation was made into whether Inhambane would not be a healthier spot for settlement. So serious was the misery that a large section of the garrison at Fort Leitsamate set up a plot to seize the magazine, arm themselves, dispatch any opposition, and head for the Portuguese factories to the north. In other words, the Dutch, there are Dutch who are going to rebel against their own because things are so miserable. The Secunde van der Kapel got wind of the scheme via information given him by a sailor boy and 62 men. A third of the garrison was placed under arrest. By the way, you're now going to see how tough the discipline of whites can be. So, the mutiny that was being plotted here. They were brought before the special court and were prosecuted by Ensign Mona, the same who led the De Kuyper expedition. There was considerable apprehension related to the trial, since the loyalty of the guards was almost as suspect as that of the prisoners. Over half the accused were sentenced to death, but lots were drawn, allowing commutation for some to a future of hard labor in chains. In the end, 22 of the mutineers were executed. Some were fixed to crosses. Their bones were broken with iron bars. By the way, what you are listening to here is basically Roman crucifixion. This is how Roman crucifixion was done. So let me repeat. Some were fixed to crosses. Their bones were broken with iron bars. Then their heads were cut off. Some were suffocated close to death and then beheaded. Others, the lucky ones, were simply hanged. Close on the heels of the trial came another calamity. A coalition of chiefs, Matashaj, Mambi, Matoli, and Mateki, attacked first Mafumbo, then Chief Kwambe, close to the small Dutch outpost. Van der Kapel immediately responded, and on 30 April 1729, sent a party of 29 soldiers and a few slaves under Ensign Mona to punish the incursion. Rashly, the scouts under Sergeant Jan Mulder fired on the coalition warriors, and the whole Dutch party was wiped out, except for a single slave survivor. The cost of the whole enterprise and the failure to produce tangible results eventually caused the Council of the Dutch East India Company to cut its losses. On 27 December 1730, the entire population of the settlement, including Van der Kapel, were taken on board the ships Snuffelaar, Zeepost, and Feyenoord, and repatriated to Cape Town. The loss of life over the decade of occupation had been appalling. The skirmish with Dawana was small in scale, but had not the check to Mona and De Kuyper occurred, the outcome of the Dutch occupation at Delagoa Bay might have been very different. Indeed, if one thinks about it, a permanent Dutch presence there might have ultimately given very different support to the future Boer Republic in Southern Africa. Let me just pause there. Because if the Dutch had stayed there in Delagoa Bay, then they would have bordered on the Transvaal, the Northern Boer Republic. So that plaque between Lower Sabi and Crocodile Bridge camps is worth a stop. As you sit there, let your imagination reenact that short, sharp engagement between Dawano and the Dutch. And that's the end of that story. But there are quite a few things that we can discuss from this. Before we return to analyzing what we've been through, I just want to show you something else, because this topic comes up a lot, and this also relates to slavery and all that. Here was all this discussion of trading with the blacks with beads. And of course, you've got all that crap in America where they carry on and on, oh, the crime of slavery, blah, 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 blah. Meanwhile, do you know, most of the blacks who ended up being slaves did not go to America. They went to Brazil. Brazil is where most of the slaves went, okay? And you don't hear anyone talking about the Brazilian government having to pay $1 trillion for the slaves, okay? This is just another Jewish scam aimed at white Americans to try and build up hatred between blacks and whites in America. And if they can't get hatred, then the other thing they're going for is to just scam the whites. So there we saw how the Dutch traded with the blacks. Never at any time did the Dutch steal from the blacks. Never at any time did the Dutch use force to get things from the blacks. They didn't go and shoot the blacks and steal their cattle. They talked to the blacks and they traded with the blacks. And when those blacks were nasty to them, they were even giving the blacks some kind of gifts in the hope that it would placate them. And then the blacks just got worse. So the Dutch were paying their way and negotiating and being diplomatic. The Dutch of 300 years ago were no different to modern whites. And the Dutch were curious about all these claims of gold and all these other things that were there, which the blacks were telling them about. But anyway, let's just take a quick look at this whole thing of trading. So here are some screenshots from various Wikipedia articles regarding trading beads. So if you look on the top left there, you'll see there are some trading beads that were used in Oklahoma in 1740. And then in the middle, you'll see that red and blue beads from Alaska. That sounds a lot more like the kind of trading beads that the Dutch were describing from their own trading. So that is probably closer to what it was like. It turns out that whites were using trading beads on other continents, on lots of other continents, from about the 1400s. So beads were a well-established currency, and it was something that was accepted by these non-whites on other continents. And it turns out that most of the beads were actually manufactured in Venice, and there were different kinds of beads. Some had glass as part of them, and they were quite heavy, actually. And as you can see from the descriptions of the Dutch are negotiating, okay? And if you go and you dig into these things in the past, you'll find that the whites were trading and doing business with these non-whites. Okay, in the case of the American slave trade, it was totally dominated by the Jews, and Jews were driving this whole business. But the fact of the matter is that other whites were doing genuine business with blacks, and they were trading, as you can see, these Dutch were trading beads for cattle. And all of it is based on the buyer and the sellers negotiating. And it's that simple. Now you've got all these Jews and liberals talking about how the whites are cheating the non-whites. But the non-whites didn't have to take the beads. They could take what suited them. And if they didn't like the beads and they didn't want to sell their stuff, they didn't have to. Nobody's forcing them to give up their stuff. You know, these non-whites are adults. They're adults. And they are trading among themselves. And they are trading with other whites that they come across. Why do liberals want us now to treat these people like as if they are children? They are adults. They make their own decisions. They don't have to trade with the whites. If they could do better somewhere else, then they could have ignored the whites. But clearly, they liked certain things that did come from the whites. And you can see the whites are giving them liquor and snuff, and they are liking certain things that the whites are bringing. And the whites also have put things on these ships so that they can trade and test out the market. And this is what came out of it. Now to come centuries later and say, oh, well, you see, the white man did this, and the white man stole that, and the white man's a thief over here. Actually, the white man isn't. The white man is negotiating with them. And I see absolutely nothing wrong with that. Now, on that image in front of you, on the top right and the middle right, are things called manillas. And these manillas are metal bars. And these are made of different types of metals and alloys. And this was a type of money that was accepted in West Africa. So those blacks were using and getting that as a form of money. And that was for trading as well. And there are variations on the theme. Now, it's interesting that a lot of those blacks are trading in metals. And I want to show you this thing in the center, this thing that says trade iron bars from 1700. And I just want to read this to you. This was found on a shipwreck, and the ship had a lot of these bars that you see, exactly like that, just a metal bar like that. So here's another aspect of the slave trade. The slave trade, where all those Jewish ships were picking up the blacks from Africa. The payment for the slaves was often in iron bars. And in one article it said this: while the bars represented a currency that the Africans accepted, negotiations about the up-to-date value of slaves were a formal and often protracted affair. English slave trader James Barbot describes a period of 6 days in June of 1699 spent haggling over terms with the king of Great Bandy. Finally, they agreed on a rate of 13 bars for men and 9 for women, and proportionally for boys and girls according to their ages. To ensure a common understanding of the relative worth of other goods, they too were assigned a value in iron. This meant that actual bars had to be used in every transaction. Rather, the price for a slave might be made up of several types of merchandise equal to the value agreed upon. So even the slave trade, okay, had a pricing structure. And in this case, blacks were willing to sell other blacks for metal bars. That had a serious value for them. Whether they melted those bars down and used it for making weaponry or whatever, I don't know. But these blacks are trading people for metal bars. They're getting paid. That's the currency they're accepting. Furthermore, these blacks in West Africa are hunting down other blacks and capturing them in order to sell them. Or they've got prisoners of war from their own wars that they're busy selling. So these are adults, okay? And they are negotiating with whites and with Jews and negotiating a way to determine what they are going to sell things for. And they are happy with these things. In their retarded culture, they can't even produce those metal bars and things, so they get it from whites. Right on the bottom, I've got a note from another article that I just wanted to read to you. And it said, Portuguese records indicated that sailing voyages in the early 16th century carried iron bars among the trade goods going farther north. During the period of the slave trade in the region, iron bars were a standard payment and wealth. So for slavery, the most accepted currency was not the US dollar, it wasn't the ruble, it was iron bars. And frankly, that's all there is to this thing. So anyone who comes along with all these stories, oh, the white people came and they cheated this one and they did that. No, the whites put all kinds of goods from Europe onto their ships. They put all kinds of goods that they too had to buy. And they went around the world and they showed people all their different goods, and the locals could choose. And it just so turns out that things like beads and iron bars were things that locals were willing to sell products for. So here we see the blacks selling their cattle for beads. But they do have choices of other things. It becomes clear that over time, because this trade is going on for centuries, that over time in different regions, people are getting used to certain currencies. That in southern Africa, beads are important, but in West Africa, iron bars are more important. Now you get all these Jew moralizing scumbags and liberals who are running around, oh, the white man cheats this and cheats that. No, man. It is the difference between our civilization. Beads don't have value in our civilization, but hey, we are happy to trade beads to go and get a cow. That's a value that works for us. And there are blacks willing to go and capture other blacks and sell them for iron bars. And you need to ask yourself, why are they doing that? Clearly, the iron bars are worth more to them than other blacks. Other blacks are worth less to them than iron bars. You know, it's not like people are forcing these blacks against their will to do this and to do that. There's a whole bunch of other stuff also related to slavery. There are empires that existed that were based on slavery, where the economy of the entire black empire was based on slavery. Those blacks went and hunted other black men, women, and children down to sell them as slaves. And they were happy with that arrangement. Slavery has been around since humans have been around. And I absolutely hate all this moralizing about the whites. Oh, the whites committed this crime, the whites committed that crime. But what about the blacks? Go and look at the blacks' behavior. How is their behavior? What can you pick up from their behavior? There were those blacks trying to kill the Dutch in order to get their beautiful sticks. Those blacks know that those, quote, beautiful sticks can kill, and that's the real reason they want them. I dealt with that issue of blacks wanting the guns of the whites in one of the videos that I did about the murder of Piet Retief and Battle of Blood River. There is an interesting document that I really need to do a video about one day where you can see the deals that blacks and whites struck. And in written format, where whites went to get land and what the blacks wanted in return for land. So let me tell you, when you hear all this Jew liberal crap about how whites are just criminals and whites are this and whites are that, whites dealt with blacks diplomatically, face to face. They went and talked to them, negotiated with them, asked them questions, reached agreements. All those things took place, and it took place in a peaceful manner. And if those blacks did not like those deals, they could have told the whites to get stuffed. But you should see this one particular deal. I must make a note to do a video about it sometime so that I can show you the actual deal and what the whites wanted and what the blacks wanted in payment for this thing. And then you'll see that actually whites have always been pretty much straight and honest in their dealings with all these different non-whites. And the fact that whites ended up coming out on top can often be pointed to the other side making bad decisions. But anyhow, I just wanted to show you a little bit of this because there's a lot of Jew claptrap, Jew liberal claptrap that's intended to make whites feel bad, when in fact history will disprove all of that liberal junk. And whites aren't the only people who engaged in slavery or engaged in trade. There were Muslims who were capturing whites on the coastlines of Europe and selling them into slavery, etc. There are white men who were castrated and turned into soldiers for the Muslims. White women and children were grabbed on beaches in Italy and other places and taken away to the Ottoman Empire to be concubines and that kind of thing. The Muslims and the Arabs did tons and tons of slave trading with blacks on the east coast of Africa. And you never hear liberals and Jews calling for reparations for that. And as I've mentioned before, you had people like Aristotle. Aristotle actually says in one place that there are peoples who deserve to be slaves. Slavery was also a form of punishment. It was an efficient form of punishment. Julius Caesar sold people into slavery. People who had engaged in treasonous behavior towards the Romans, he freaking took these people and said, "You're a bunch of scum. I had an agreement with you. You cheated me. You people wanted to rebel. You had weapons, etc., and you wanted to attack us. You know, and I'm taking you and I'm selling the whole bunch of you into slavery, and that's your punishment." Now you live in this time where you got all these Jews and liberals trying to make you think that, oh, everybody who was a slave was innocent. No, lots of slaves were prisoners of war and all kinds of other things. Now we want to run around and say, oh, no, you know, this and that and here and there, and shouldn't have done this, and this was immoral. Meanwhile, everybody else on the freaking planet has been doing it as well, hey? I must tell you, I'm so sick to death of all this anti-white moralizing that all these scumbags come up with hundreds of years after the event. It is a total misrepresentation of life, of the values of the time, of the interactions between our civilization and their civilization. If they are willing to accept beads for cattle, then that tells you something about their products, that is all that they've got that we actually want, and that something that doesn't mean much to us means a lot to them. So let's return to the De Kuyper expedition. It turns out that the real reason the Dutch struggled and didn't stay in what was to become Mozambique is due to the mosquito and fever. I'm suspecting that this is a reference to malaria, because malaria is the mosquito that is present in this area, and that these Dutch are dying from malaria. But notice that the Dutch are suffering. They are dealing with a disease that their bodies are not accustomed to, whereas the blacks are more accustomed to this, and the blacks are able to more or less survive. There are probably blacks who are dying from malaria, but because they breed at their rate that they do, they are able to survive. And they probably have got some kind of immunity, or they are less affected by malaria. So there aren't many Dutch there, and they really have a hard time. And you can see that in the original expedition, two-thirds of them died quite quickly. So these Dutch are taking a beating. And this is one of the reasons why whites didn't come to Africa, was even though Africa is warmer than North America, the big problem in Africa is disease. So the whites may have brought their diseases to North America, which affected the Red Indians, but hey, in Africa, the whites were the ones that were battling with diseases. And you don't have to listen to all that Jew screeching from America about, you know, how the whites came and killed everybody with their diseases. No, the whites were being killed by diseases at quite a hell of a pace. So let's look at the events once the blacks start getting violent. The blacks have warned the Dutch, but the Dutch, the little Dutch group of men, they've been given a job to do. They have to go and try and carry out their orders. They've been given a job to do, and they try to their utmost to carry it out. And even though the blacks are talking about killing them, etc., this little Dutch group just keeps on keeping on. It keeps on trying to get somewhere, to get something that they can go back and show their leader, their boss, that they have done their task. And eventually, they only turn around when the blacks actually physically try to kill them. And yet, they've got a lot of courage. They are clearly outnumbered. There are lots of blacks. There are, at the very least, 500 or more blacks that are coming at them. And here they are now deep in this territory, and they have to survive. But the thing that keeps them alive is their military discipline and that they kill blacks. And that even though they're just a few, that the moment that the blacks see that these whites can kill them quite quickly, these blacks then start backing off. And if you look at all these different incidents, you'll see that there was that point where after a number of these incidents had occurred, it gets to a point where the Dutch say to them, next day when they were again threatened, they told their interpreters to warn their shadowers, the blacks following them, that at the slightest sign of attack, they would kill them all and burn down their houses. And after the Dutch told the blacks that they'll kill them all and burn down their houses, after that, the blacks never gave them trouble again. In fact, from then onwards, as they go to other places, they then find that the blacks greet them with open arms. And it tells you, for example, here towards the end, it says, here the inhabitants greeted them with great joy, the women tearing branches from the trees and waving them above their heads. Now listen to this. Others used the branches to sweep clean the path before them. So all of a sudden, now the blacks are like so freaking friendly. They're even coming with the branches and sweeping the path in front of the whites as the whites are walking. Oh, now they're so happy that they are here. But the only thing that worked for the Dutch in the end was that they had to shoot the freaking blacks. And that whenever they got angry and the blacks showed their viciousness, and the Dutch responded by killing some of the blacks, then the blacks started changing. Then they started running away. And when the Dutch became really tough, and the Dutch told them, we'll kill you all and we'll burn down your houses, suddenly all the blacks were absolutely well behaved. Everybody now likes them. Everybody likes them. And look at that time when the blacks were screaming, let us devour the white people. And when the Dutch heard that and they shot a couple of them, then that started changing the mood there. So this little group of Dutch, after that nasty ambush, they still had that long journey back and all the threats and things that they had to deal with in their journey back. That was quite something that they went through. Because clearly they had to walk long, long distances. And they were just carrying on day in and day out to try to get back to safety. It was quite an amazing feat. And I suspect that they were probably starting to get quite hungry because they already had a shortage of cattle. I don't even know if they had managed to keep their cattle on their return journey. But a very important lesson that I've got to tell you is that you'll hear Jews and liberals saying, oh no, you know, the white man treats the non-whites so badly and that's why the non-whites are like that. That's bullshit, okay? Here you can see that the Dutch treated the blacks nicely all along and they had blacks who were working for them. Why were there blacks who were working for them? Clearly, those blacks were happy with whatever they were being paid. So there were blacks that were happy to be their guides, blacks who were happy to be their interpreters, etc. But clearly, it is the blacks, especially the chiefs, who are starting to feel threatened by what? A tiny little group of 30 Dutch. Little group of Dutch who are exploring in their territories. If these blacks are the super civilization where the king wears golden armor and all that, then, you know, what's there to fear? But in actual fact, there is no golden armor. There's a whole bunch of stories. And it's actually these blacks who are telling these tall tales that are actually helping to make the Dutch even more curious. And the real military disaster for the Dutch was a couple of years later in 1729 when the chiefs, when these black chiefs were now operating as a coalition and they were threatening the Dutch. And the Dutch sent some troops out and they shot at these blacks. But clearly this time there were enough blacks to kill all 29 Dutch. And that shows you that if the blacks see the chance to kill you, they do. And you've got to look out for yourself. These blacks are serious. They would have wiped out the De Kuyper expedition if they could have. It was just that those whites were much sharper and more aggressive, and they kept their heads and they managed to assess their military threats properly and they managed to survive. So what the De Kuyper expedition did and how they survived and managed to get all that distance back to Delagoa Bay, that's actually quite a thing that happened there. Those guys were pretty amazing because for them it was touch and go. They could have been gone. And again, it shows you the danger of the situations that our ancestors faced. So in total, how many blacks the De Kuyper expedition faced as it traveled and as it stumbled on various villages of blacks? There were clearly hundreds of blacks around in different places, and they tried to avoid them when they could. Other times they couldn't avoid them. But what really saved their asses was when the blacks began to realize that this little group of Dutch will kill them and that they pack a punch. And then another thing that just shows you how hard life was for the whites of that time is this whole story of the mutiny, where a third of the people decide that they're going to mutiny. And then the governor manages to catch them out, arrest them, etc. And then the punishment that he dishes out. There's a trial, and this is nasty stuff, where at the end of the day, out of all of these people that he arrested, that he decided that 22 of the mutineers had to be executed. Some were fixed to crosses, their bones were broken with iron bars, then their heads were cut off, some were suffocated close to death and then beheaded, and others were hanged. So life was hard, okay? And that's something that doesn't come through enough. All these liberal and Jew sacks of shit who talk to you about white history and European history, they forget the hardships that our people lived through, even inside Europe. And, you know, the laws that we have as a people, these laws are not frivolous nonsense that we just think up because we're a bunch of goofballs. These laws are thought up as a direct consequence of human experience. We execute people for treason because treason can result in tremendous harm to our people. Tremendous harm. And treason is always punished by death. That is our standard in our civilization. It's always been this way. And if you look at the modern world that Jews and liberals are creating for us, they want treason, treason mustn't be punished, no more death penalty, etc. Meanwhile, treason should be punished. Those freaking people should be drawn and quartered. They should be eaten by lions. They should be killed the way that the Romans or any other whites would have killed them. These people have absolutely no regard for society and the state and the group. That one spy can cause tremendous damage. That treason can cause huge damage. Treason done properly can result in more damage to a state than having an entire army destroyed. There are reasons why we punish the way we punish. And even things like horse thieves. I was reading some time back that at a point they made it a capital crime. If you stole a horse, you'd be executed. But you need to go and look at the conditions of the whites at the time. That there are some kinds of crimes where we really are going to struggle. They didn't have computers, they didn't have this, they didn't have that. You could go and steal someone's horse. How are they ever going to find you again? And you're dealing with something that is very expensive by the terms of that day. It's the same as someone maybe stealing your car, but perhaps even more expensive than stealing your car. You need to look at the context of the whites of the time. And there are lots and lots and lots of things that we nowadays just take for granted. And we forget what our ancestors went through to do those things, to get those goods. Clothing was handmade. There were lots of things that had to be made slowly through care and hard work. Now you got all these Jewish sacks of shit and liberals just opening up everything. Oh no, this this law mustn't be there, that mustn't be there. And now you get all kinds of things that you probably didn't have in ancient times. You know, serial killers, all kinds of weird things where people commit endless amounts of crime. I personally am a big believer in deterrence. That is a big part of our history, is that we punish people and we give out harsh punishments, but we do it for a reason. Because in our society, we don't have unlimited goods. We don't have unlimited opportunities. We solve many problems also through behavior and discipline. We solve, in our civilization, we solve many problems through self-discipline, telling the truth, being honest. Those things have got a value beyond anything in money. It saves us so much hassle. And these are behavioral things that are inculcated into our people. And it results in a system that is much stronger and much more pleasant and much more productive than all these other stupid civilizations and groups like Jews, where they have no respect for truth and honesty. They then sit with all kinds of other problems that come out of it, all kinds of failures in their civilization. Even in modern day Africa, I can tell you that the fact that blacks are a low trust society and they have a disregard for the truth, it hampers them in more ways than you can believe. A lot of their poverty and all their backwardness is related to their attitude to the truth. These people are dysfunctional, and there are lessons that our race has learned through blood, sweat, and tears of thousands of years. There's all kinds of lessons. There are all kinds of behaviors and standards in our civilization that come from lots and lots of experience, trial and error, from dozens of societies and civilizations and empires and states that we've produced in the past. We behave and have certain standards, and those standards are based on past experience. And that is one of the reasons why we mustn't just let these Jews and liberals make us change all our rules. We should actually not have been changing any of our rules. Capital punishment and all these other things that we had, we should not be changing any of these things. A thing that is killing us is all kinds of weird moralizing under all kinds of silly conditions that whites never used to do. So as cruel as it is what those Dutch did, that was the standard for the time. And when it comes to things like treason and the things that can happen to us, I look back on our history in Southern Africa. We whites in Africa, one of our weaknesses is that we never punished other whites for treason the way we should have. All of us were too soft on our traitors. There are plenty of Jews that were among us that should have been hanged. And we'll discuss those topics in time to come. Virtually everything that has come from the Jews and the liberals and the commies and the left is absolute nation-wrecking nonsense. But returning to the Dutch, it shows what the Dutch were trying to do. It shows just one of many experiments by our race as we tried different things in different places. And in this particular case, it didn't work out for the Dutch. But it should show you that we used our technology, we used our brains, we used our courage, we went and tried all kinds of things. And sometimes we did fail. But we risked our lives, and many of our people died and suffered from all kinds of terrible things. But one thing about us is we don't lack courage, we don't lack initiative, and hey, you can say what you like, but the Dutch were brave. Even to the point where those masses of tribes, you get 29 guys going to fight what looks like was probably a big black army. You can't fault these people in terms of courage and determination. They did their utmost. And that's our race. We're just not a bunch of crybabies. We're just not a bunch of weenies that sit and moan and groan about things. We're always out there trying and making a plan, and we risk everything. We have risked everything on many occasions. And when we go and we look closer at warfare, you'll see the scale on which we can risk and take huge risks. But we are creative and we're out there. And if it wasn't for us, this world would not be in the state that it is in. And very sadly, all these other races have benefited massively from us, actually. And the Dutch had an empire, and all other Europeans had empires. And when I look at what our people went through, I don't see anything wrong with our efforts. The fact that we gained the power and we ruled others is because we are intrepid, we are people who try things, and there is not a race on this planet that white men have been afraid of facing. And just watching that tiny group of Dutch, those tiny groups of Dutch men, you cannot fault them on courage. They faced groups of blacks, no matter how outnumbered they were. There was no shortage of courage there. We are creative, we are disciplined, we explore, and hey, we've done awesome things. And don't let all the old crybaby, cowardly, loser, weakling sacks of shit like Jews and liberals get you down, because we're in a whole different level compared to them. They are the parasites and the losers that follow in our wake. But we are the ones who pioneer. We are the ones who risk death. And we all do it. All of us do it. Every single European country has done that. You can slice it how you like it. But we are freaking awesome. And to think that nowadays people want to give up all of civilization, and you look back on our ancestors, go and look back on the history of our ancestors, the blood, sweat, and tears that they lived through, the nightmares that those people lived through, and then you'll see that, you know what, it would be a freaking sin for us to give up on Western civilization. We would be beyond useless to give up on that which has been built by the brave, by the intrepid, by the clever. I just want to return to an important topic before I wind up this video, and that is the issue of power. Power is something that whites, as a rule, just ignore, but power is extremely important. I just want to return to the piece where De Kuyper was talking to the blacks when they were retreating, and when they got to these blacks, and where De Kuyper actually engaged in a little bit of psychology there, where he asked the blacks at these villages where they were now very hostile to the Dutch, and he asked the blacks through an interpreter, why are they aggressive towards the Dutch? Because there are some things there that need a bit more attention. So let me read that section again. De Kuyper asked them through an interpreter the reason for their aggression. And this is what the blacks replied. Because the Dutch were passing through their land, they replied. And because they wanted everything that belonged to the Dutch, including their flintlocks, which they called Hongo Songilo, beautiful sticks. The sergeant threw two bunches of beads towards them, and the soldiers threw some other trinkets, thinking that this might make them desist from their threats. Instead, they just shouted like mad dogs. The term like mad dogs is what De Kuyper wrote in his diary. And they shouted, Hote, Hote, Molongi, let us devour the white people. When the Dutch heard this, they took aim and shot seven of their assailants, killing six and wounding one in the leg. At this, the warrior band took fright. There were about 500 of them, and most fled. So there's a bunch of stuff that I just want to go back to unpack again, because it's really important. So here are the poor Dutch, 30 guys facing 500 warriors, and they are asking, "Why are you so aggressive towards us?" Okay? So the one answer is now because the Dutch are passing through their land. Though right from the beginning, the Dutch have been asking them to go through their land and to go to the different places, and they did everything by the book and they dealt with everybody. But now it's a problem, okay? But what's more important than that is this, where it says, because the Dutch were passing through their land, they replied, and because they wanted everything that belonged to the Dutch, including their flintlocks, their guns. So the blacks are now saying that they now also want everything that the Dutch have got, everything, including those beautiful sticks. So you can see the greed of the blacks. They've seen all these things that the white man has. Now they lust after it. And then when the sergeant and the soldiers throw the beads and the trinkets at the blacks, hoping that by giving them something that they'll calm down. And instead, what happens? They give them something and then they shout, "Hote, hote, Molongi. Let us devour the white people." Now, why are they doing that? Let's return to the animal nature of humans, that it's all about power. And when the blacks see the Dutch giving them stuff, the blacks are thinking to themselves, "These people are giving us stuff because they are weak." That is how the blacks are seeing it. This is a thing that I'm going to bring up again and again. It's something that you can actually see clearly once you start observing these non-whites. And this will apply to everybody, including the Jews, etc., that when they see weakness, they will ruthlessly exploit it. And these blacks don't think in terms of morality. All that Christian morality of I'm doing this because it's good and I must avoid that because it's evil. That's not how these people are thinking. These people are observing you to see if you are strong or if you are weak. And if they see weakness, then they start gaining confidence and then they come after you. This is a recurring theme, and it's a theme that I've seen in my own life. As whites lose power, as you become less, you start to see that they get more aggressive. So the time that you think that you can now reach out with good or kindness and all that stuff does not work. It does not work because they too are animals, and the animals are looking at power. The only morality that exists is the morality of power. He who has power and he who is dominant can, at his leisure, offer kindness to others. And that is the situation that the vast majority of whites are in most of the time. And whites begin to think later that, when we are weak and the blacks are strong or the Jews are strong or somebody else is strong, they will be kind to us. You are completely and utterly wrong. And if you ever base your future on that kind of thinking, you will be killed. And I'm not joking with you. This is the brutal nature of life on earth. And we whites are so used to strength and dominance that we forget the hatred, the greed, and the lust that others have. And those who are weaker, they lust and want certain things. And if they see the chance where they can slit your throat and get what they want, they will. And I'm not overstating these things. These are very important things to understand. And I can't tell you the nightmare that Jews and liberals have unleashed on the Western world by allowing all these other immigrants to pour in. They have created such a problem for all of you. Don't you believe that the future is going to be better? It's going to get worse. And the weaker you get, and the more you behave like these Dutch did here, where they were trying to calm them down by giving them stuff, that stuff does not work. And when they see these things, they see it as a sign of weakness, and then they get even more aggressive. Everything liberals have taught you is total garbage. It's total garbage. And even if part of it is true, it's not going to change anything in a way that you're going to like. I'll return to these topics because we need to discuss diversity more. Diversity is the worst idea that you can imagine. Having lots of different races, different biological entities in the same country, in the same society, you are asking for endless problems, which will just get worse. So it is only when they shout at the Dutch and say, let us devour the white people, and then the Dutch have had a guts full of it and they shoot these blacks, and then when they shoot them, suddenly the blacks are frightened. Even though they massively outnumber the Dutch, suddenly when the Dutch kill some of them, then these people are frightened and then they back off. And most of them run away. So power is what saves the Dutch. Kindness is not saving them. Power is what's saving them. And in the animal world, power is everything. You can see power at work in nature in the animal world. You will see animals that chase each other, fight each other. They can fight each other for sexual rights. They can fight each other for territory. Territory is a thing that is a big thing in the animal kingdom. And birds and lions and all kinds of animals operate on territory boundaries. And this stuff from nature is firmly at work among humans. And power ultimately gets expressed through combat and war. And I want to return to that because there's the concept that's been put out there, might is right, etc., which is actually just another interpretation of what Nietzsche said. But I want to return to those topics because those are very important topics. And in the real world, there's a lot of natural nature type of stuff that is at work among human beings and among groups of human beings. And from what I've seen of blacks and my own experience with blacks and when I grew up and all that kind of stuff, I can't emphasize enough that there's only one thing that black people really respect, and that is power, raw power. Black people respect it even among themselves. If you look at their leaders, that if they have a leader who comes and he bashes people into the ground and he kills people and he dominates them, then you'll see the blacks love it. They love it. There is, in fact, even such a concept among the Russians. The Russians also have an obsession with being ruled by strong men. And strength and power is very important. And in terms of survival for whites, I cannot tell you how important it is to show power to blacks. That if you don't show power to these people and you don't respond with power, they will start to look down on you and they will actually disrespect you. And then they'll behave even worse. You've been misled by Jews especially, but Jews followed by the stupid liberal whites. You've been misled into believing that if you just let black people do all their stuff freely, that they're going to be okay. And you should already have noticed in the United States especially, but in Europe as well, what happens when you just let people go, okay? Our society has got different concepts to their societies. These things are not documented, but these things exist. These are things that exist in their society, in their culture, things that exist in our society, in our culture. We've got a lot of stuff where we act on discipline. where we actually have a group instinct where we want everyone to behave the same. That's actually a very powerful feature of whites. We have a very strong group instinct and a group behavior that we want for ourselves and for each other. We are very insistent on certain things. And those things that we're insistent on don't necessarily exist in other races and other groups. And there are many instances I can show you where blacks have been led by whites and they prefer white leadership because whites have got better skills. But part of that always includes power and respect. And in the case of these Dutch, the Dutch would have been killed if they had been weak. And I do want to return to this issue of power. It is critically important for the survival of our race that we have power and that we use power. And it's male power that's needed. And male power is needed in order to defend our societies and in order to hold on to what we have. And it is a thing that we have to do. If we don't do it, let's return to some of those quotes from Hitler where he's talking about nature, where he says, life on this planet is an eternal struggle, where he says, the one thing that is never forgiven is weakness. Weakness is never forgiven. Nature does not forgive weakness. Nature will kill you. And when you are dealing with real survival stuff, like these Dutch were, it's a case of do or die. And the behavior of that Frans de Kuyper group was perfect. They really used their heads and they really kept themselves together as they were operating deep inside this black territory. And power is very, very important. I cannot stress it enough. Even right now. And people think that no, you must just sit back and let them calm down. No, you need to demonstrate physical power. And as a group and as a race, we need to do this more. Let me tell you that in the real animal world, the raw animal world that's out there, is that he who has the power to dominate, that is the one that is respected. And if you don't do that with the blacks will run amok. Now, of course, the question is, do you really want to also do those things with the blacks? Do we need to actually even coexist with the blacks? My personal view is that we need to function in our own societies. Let them go and do what the hell they want to do. Let the Jews go off and do what the hell they want to do. But let whites do what we want to do. And what we want to do, our values are pretty fixed, and our values have not really changed in hundreds or even thousands of years. And there are values that we have that we need to bring back. For example, I don't have a particular problem with the Dutch even crucifying those traitors of theirs, because I have looked at this issue of treason, and I must tell you that treason needs to be punished. People who harm the entire group and put the entire group at risk. That is a very, very nasty thing. And there are lots of spies, including Jewish spies, who got away with stuff in America who should actually have been executed. Seriously, this is not a joke. That Jew rat scumbag Pollard, that guy should have been executed. But there are many. When we get back to South African stuff, you'll see the instances where white South Africans didn't punish Jews and whites the way they should have. This is where the Europeans and the British have got a much better established pattern where if there is treason and certain kinds of, let's call it, high crimes against the group, where they then punish seriously. And that is something that the whites that left Europe don't do enough. Finally, the blacks are adults. Jews are adults. And you know what? They make decisions in their lives. And they make fucked up decisions in their lives. And it's not our job to be their nannies. It is not our job to look after these people. And if they make bad decisions and they live their life in a screwed up way and they're culture works in a fucked up way. Okay, that's not our problem. That's not our problem. Our culture is awesome, and our culture has come through all kinds of trials and tribulations. Our culture is something that has grown out of hardship, out of struggle, out of strife, etc. And we can be and should be proud of our culture and proud of our methods. And we must continue to improve our methods. But we should not sit and feel sorry for these other people. I've looked at these people, and I must tell you that one should never feel sorry for these other races. Everybody's an adult. And all these people also insist on freedom. And one should say to them, okay, you be free, go and do what you want to do. But if your group clashes with our group, okay, we're going to clobber you. And when you have that approach to life, we must not run around. We must not run around with charity. Oh, you don't have a house. We need to build you a house. You don't have a house because you're an asshole, okay? The reason your society is going down is because you're a stupid prick, okay? And you have made this and this bad decision. And that is not our problem, okay? And the fact that we've managed to do better than you, or we've managed to overcome you, don't feel sorry for them. We must stop feeling sorry when we win. We are letting too much emotional Jewish claptrap, guilt tripping, all kinds of stuff. We're letting all this kind of crap, we are letting all this kind of crap cloud our judgment. And it's making us weaker. This world is an animal world. And I want to tell you that in the same way that Franz de Kuyper's group managed to survive, but look at that other group of Dutch later who tried to fight that bigger coalition and they were all killed. Okay? Understand that the moment that these others can devour us and kill us, they will. They will. And just because it hasn't happened doesn't mean it can't happen. And whites need to be up on their game. We need to look after our interests firmly. But in Africa, I can tell you, from the earliest times right to modern times, the animal is at work and blacks only respect power. And when they see you are strong, then they will behave themselves. They'll behave. If you want to see blacks behaving, they'll behave when you are strong. In the same way that those Dutch said, we will kill you all and we'll burn down your houses. And then what happened? All the blacks were as nice as hell to them, hey? All of a sudden, the Dutch didn't have to be liberal. The Dutch just said to them, listen, we're going to kill all of you. And by the way, that's a pretty cool thing. It's just a little bunch of Dutch, 30 Dutch guys and hundreds, if not thousands of blacks. In those various villages, it was obvious that there were villages with hundreds of blacks, you know, a chief arriving with 500 of his supporters. So here are 30 Dutch walking in the midst of a black empire, and they're in the middle of this black empire, and there are lots of villages. As they're traveling, they come upon one village and another village, and there are hundreds of blacks at least in each village. So imagine the balls of the Dutch, okay, big freaking balls, to turn around and say to the blacks, we will kill all of you and we'll burn your houses down. And those blacks had seen what the Dutch could do. They had seen death, and they knew that, you know, this little group of kick-ass whites, they can do this, man. And look at how that changed the game for them. And it made them safe, and it allowed them to finish off their trip. And, you know, even to the point where the blacks are taking branches from trees and sweeping the paths in front of them, you know, as a sign of respect, you know, we're clearing the way for you, etc. Look at that. That didn't come from liberalism. That didn't come from liberalism. That came from strength and the determination to fight and kill. That's what brought them that. And let me tell you something, that is the only way forward on this planet, is that we as a race, we must know how to use our strength, and we mustn't bugger around. And stop feeling guilty when we defeat others. Stop feeling guilty when we smash others. Stop feeling guilty when we win, man. And let us look after ourselves and our civilization. That's the most important thing. Build our future so that our future is great. It's not for us to go and build freaking houses and things for blacks and others. And if white Americans wiped out the Indians, well, good for the white Americans. It's an awesome conquest for whites. Our ancient ancestors would never have had the slightest problem with that. If our ancestors had to be told, listen, we went to another continent and we killed most everybody who's there and we took it all over. Let me tell you, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, any of the whites of the past, they'd have said, that's freaking awesome. That's freaking awesome. And here we are, where we are operating in a totally different world, where we are feeling sorry for all these other fools and scumbags and so forth, instead of us winning. And we should focus on winning. Strengthen ourselves, build up our stuff, and let's go and win. And win big, okay? Win big the way that whites used to win in the past, when the conquistadors were in South America and Mexico, when the white Americans, the greatest racial conquest in the history of the world, when white Americans and Canadians, basically British and French and everybody, when Europeans went to North America and took it over completely. And now you people, you got Jews busy misleading you, and now you're doing the opposite, man. It's insane. But one thing you must never lose sight of, never lose sight of this, is remember that when those non-whites and Jews and so forth and these blacks are saying, we're going to devour you, they mean it. And if they get the chance, they will do it. So keep these things in mind. It is very important that we defend ourselves and that we never trust these people. Don't trust these people. Look out for our own interests first and foremost. And don't feel sorry, man. Don't feel sorry. Nature's on our side. Nature's on our side. Don't feel sorry for these people. If nature's busy killing them, let nature kill them. Because let me tell you, that you will see, just like the Dutch died of illnesses, etc. Nobody came to help the Dutch, hey? Nobody came to help the Dutch. And whites should wake up. Nobody's coming to help you and me. We've got to look out for ourselves. Our race must look out for itself. And we mustn't feel sorry for these people, regardless of what's happened to them, regardless of their bullshit. And if they come and say, oh no, well, you cheated us here, and somebody else, got enslaved, hey, that's crybaby shit. You did what you did in the past. We're not responsible for the stuff you did. Go away. Grow up. Grow up. We're not your parents. We're not related to you. You are nothing to us. Go away. And we mustn't be shy about looking after our own. We must look after our own. And we must see to it that our stuff grows and our stuff moves forward. And to hell with what anyone else says. Let me leave you with this final image here. This is from a meme here in South Africa. Let me explain this to you. We speak Afrikaans. We've got Afrikaans and English as our two European languages that we have in South Africa. And Afrikaans is basically 17th century Dutch. And some years ago, there was a campaign by these black crybabies, and they were carrying on with this hashtag, Afrikaans must fall. So that is the language spoken by the Boers. So this is one of a number of memes that were put out by Boers. And so it says, what do we say to hashtag Afrikaans must fall? And the answer is, nie fokken vandag nie. And what that means, that translation is not fucking today. So the answer to Afrikaans must fall is not fucking today. And there are people that feel strong about their language and their culture. So it's still alive and well, make no mistake. And they use that Afrikaans language as a way of getting by lots of things that the blacks would otherwise have done to try and destroy us. The way in which the Boers play with Afrikaans and they put their kids into Afrikaans schools, etc., that's a big thing in South Africa. And that's how they keep their culture alive, and they keep a distance from all these other things, because the blacks don't like Afrikaans. So that's the Dutch influence, alive and well, almost 400 years after the first Dutch set foot in South Africa.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, you know you don't.